The podcast, today we're going to be talking to an extremely inspirational individual, somebody who's overcome a range of challenges in their life, somebody who's represented Team GB at the Paralympics, somebody who's bench pressed over 190 kilograms, and somebody who's got an extremely motivational, inspirational outlook on life, who's going to explain their story, and hopefully you can take some of the things they say and apply it to your daily life. So sit back, relax, and I hope you enjoy today's episode. Hi, Ali. Could you give me a bit of a brief introduction to your childhood from sort of when you were born until sort of maybe your teenage years, and give us a bit of insight into that, please?
Yeah, so I was born in Lebanon at a time where there was a lot of conflict at the time. So the war was going on with Israel and basically, I think disabled people just didn't really, didn't really exist in Lebanon back then. It was hidden. Because normal people just didn't have a life, disabled people just weren't even in the list of existence. So when I was born, the doctor kind of asked my parents if they wanted to kind of get rid of me, because there's no life for a disabled person in Lebanon at the time. Luckily, my parents said no, it's a blessing. So they decided that actually for me to have a normal life, I needed to be in a country that gave me opportunities. Luckily, my uncle lived in the UK, he worked here. So the UK was the first option, Australia being the second. It should have been Australia, to be fair, but here we are in the UK. So we came over when I was 6 months old. And I think from what I remember from my childhood, it was actually a very happy one. I didn't really have any kind of major issues. So we lived in Tottenham. My parents had a choice between sending me to a special needs school or a mainstream school, and they decided that for me to reach my potential would be a mainstream school. But the caveat on that was they took me to a school that had no facilities for disabled people. In fact, no lifts, no ramps. No carers. They go, look, this is life, go and adapt. And so as a kid, I thought it was completely normal not having any facilities. I just adapted as I went along. And that actually put me in good stead, because like looking back now, I'd never get away with what I did back then. So climbing up the stairs, kind of lifting the chair up and down the stairs as well, like walking on the floor on all fours. I would never have gotten away with it back now. But it did taught me that. It taught me that, you know, I can adapt to anything. And if there's no barrier there, then I should just go through it. So, my parents, I was quite lucky that they took me to a school that had no facilities at all.
Do you think going into a school like that then and having to adapt to your surroundings, do you think that potentially fueled your career in terms of being an athlete, to push yourself harder and harder and harder? Because if you'd gone into an environment where you're not being pushed and not being challenged, you maybe have had a bit more of a comfortable, bit more of an easier sort of journey through school, whereas you've gone into an environment where you've needed to adapt to the surroundings. Do you think that helped you?
I think looking back, I think the one thing that shocked people was just how much I could do. I think I didn't really realise, because I thought, like, I was born without any legs. So for me, I didn't know anything different. I didn't think it was a shock me going up and down the stairs because we were at home. I didn't think it was a shock me climbing. It was in a shock me playing with, you know, sport at how everybody else played. But to everybody else, like, he's on all fours, he's playing all the sports without any adaptions. He's beating everybody, and he doesn't really, he's like a carefree attitude, which is like crazy. So I was always in the popular group in school. I was never bullied. Nobody actually messed with me, which is good. But I think it kind of opened the eyes of the school that actually they couldn't just allow not to have any facilities. They had to do something. So I think my legacy was they actually built facilities, which is great for the disabled people that came after me. But at the time, I didn't really comprehend just what I was doing. It was just me doing what I usually do. And people were like, oh, this is nuts. I'm like, what do you mean? I do this every day. So I didn't think it was a big deal, but everybody else around me, like, thought it was a big deal. But then when they got used to me, it became very, very normal. And I got treated the same. And when it came to sport, everyone was as aggressive on me than everybody else. So I demanded it. I didn't accept anything less. So yeah, like for me, I had a very good childhood growing up. It's just the school did change. It had to eventually.
Yeah, of course. So how did you get into powerlifting then? I've read somewhere that you got into it at 16. A lot of our students who are 16, they go to the gym, but they're not really involved in that elite level of powerlifting. They go and they try and build a bit of biceps, a bit of triceps, and a bit of chest, and they want to sort of look good. But how did you get involved then into powerlifting at 16?
So I think my Paralympic dream probably started when I was 6 years old. I watched Michael Johnson in the 96 Olympic Games. So he won 200 and 400 meter Olympic gold. It's not been done since. It's, you know, like probably the best performances you're ever going to get. Even though he was American, I remember him being on top of the podium, and there was a contrast between how he competed, because he was incredible, but on the podium, he literally burst into tears. For a strange reason was, I thought, well, I wanted to feel what he's feeling. Like, how can somebody be so good and then just drop down crying their eyes out? And I felt like I needed to feel what he was feeling. But I knew that I had no legs, so I couldn't run like him. But I knew I wanted to get to the Olympics. Back then it was the Olympics, because I didn't know there was a Paralympic Games at all. So I knew that I needed to find a sport that I was good at to get to that sort of level. So it was actually when I was 11 that I started judo. And I did judo at the top, a top age group level, I'd say, for about 5 years. But I had to quit judo because we found out in 2004 that at the Paralympic Games, it's only open for blind and visually impaired, not for amputees, because obviously Paralympic sport is classification. You're put in a classification of a disability, and judo wasn't open to amputees at the time. And it still isn't open to amputees. So it was hard for me because I literally sacrificed my life for like 4 years as a kid thinking that I could make it. Judo was my first love of sport, so it was quite hard. So me coming from an Arabic background, parents all about education rather than sport, and especially back then. And it was my GCSE year when I had to quit judo. So I focused on my GCSEs to get good grades. And I was lucky enough to get into one of the top, by the time it was the top college in the country, with my grades, which was lucky for me. Especially where I came from in Tottenham, you don't get into that sort of college. So I knew I had some brains, but I was literally depressed for about a year, thinking my Paralympic dream is over. Like, what do I do? Like, yes, I've got the education side, but my dream was to always make the Paralympic Games. So during my maths GCSE exam, I think it was afterwards, my friend literally forced me to go to the gym across the road from the school. So I've never touched a barbell in my life. Like for judo training, it's only bodyweight stuff and like just grappling. But I never actually touched weights before. So he literally forced me to go to the gym. And on the first day that I was in the gym, I lifted 100 kilo bench press. And obviously the whole gym stopped, stared at me, and they're like, who is this person? Now I thought I did something wrong. I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't even know like what a barbell was. And this big guy comes up to me, he said, can you stay here for a minute? I have to go get somebody. Now, I generally thought I did something wrong. So I said to my friend, let's put the weights away and get out of here. I don't know what I've done. And my friend's like, I don't know what you've done. Like, we always get into trouble. And it was kind of really like scared. So we literally tried to get out of the reception and I got stopped by this old man. And he goes to me, do you know what you've done? And I was like, no, please don't hurt me. I'm going to go home. He said, well, you just bench pressed 100 kilo. And looking at you, you're probably about, 15, 16? And looking at your body weight, he said, you're probably what, lightweight, middleweight? And I said, well, I don't know what I weigh. I've never weighed myself really the last year or so. He goes, look, you need to come back. He said, I used to coach the national team at the Paralympic Games. And I've never seen anything like this, not your age. So that was my second chance. Here we are now 15 years later.
It's amazing that how people come across their sort of their sport. You never touched the barbell and you've put up two plates aside and you've benched 100 kilograms at 15, 16, which is incredible. And without, you know, you say going with your friend to the gym, you may never have found that. And we say to kids all the time at school, just try something new, because you might be okay at football, but you're only ever going to be okay at football as you pick up a rugby ball, you pick up a cricket bat, you pick up anything, javelin, shot put. You might be incredible. You don't know unless you try it. And you don't know where your passion is until you try it. So from sort of 15, 16, that first journey into that first sort of experience in the gym, where did you go from there? What did that guy say to you? Did he all of a sudden put you onto a program, or did he just let you experiment with the gym? How did your next step go from there?
So, put into perspective, the gym had no facilities for disabled people. It was just a very old, dirty, smelly, spit and sawdust gym. Now, luckily for me, I grew up with the Rocky films, the Rocky Balboa films. So I love that sort of atmosphere. And in judo as well, I used to always listen to Rocky. So for me, I was in a Rocky environment. So for me, I didn't really mind, didn't care. He did say to me that, I'm in a powerlifting as a sport that is not about classification. It's about body weight only. So you'll be competing against everybody, every disability, which makes it quite unique, which makes it very competitive. And I think people are going to be aware that it's not a secret that in a sport like mine, doping was rife at the top levels. We didn't really do well in this country because we are a clean nation. We've got very good anti-doping rules here and everyone's tested, but unfortunately globally it's not a very good sport for anti-doping historically. So he said to me, this was the first week I was there, he really opened my eyes. He said, look, in 10 years time, you're going to be on the platform. You're going to be on the podium at a World Paralympic Games potentially. And you might not be first, you might be second or third. And the people in front of you are cheating. You've got two choices. You either do what they're doing and win at all costs, or you can sleep well at night knowing you're the best clean athlete on the planet and you scared the crap out of these, you know, these druggies. He said, if you don't pick the latter, get out of my gym, because I only coach clean athletes. So that really opened my eyes at 15. I guess at the time we were 2 years away from Beijing, the Beijing Paralympic Games. And he said, look, there's no way you're going to qualify. You're too young. You have to be in the top 10 men in the world to go. Men. There's no junior category in the Paralympic Games. And at the time, that was 180 kilo. And he said, juniors do not do well because it's a old person sport, because it takes a very long time to develop that strength.
Yeah.
But he said, if you come four times a week, we'll get you to 2012. But at the time, we didn't know where 2012 was going to be. So we were just like, right, at 2012, I might make my first Paralympics. But luckily, I committed to four times a week. And on my 19th birthday, I broke the senior British record, which has not been broken in 25 years, to qualify for the Beijing Paralympic Games. So it was the greatest birthday present anybody could hope for. And that British record, the guy that had it before me, was considered one of the greatest ever lifters we've ever had in this country. So for me to break it at 19... get me to the games was unexpected within 2 years of starting the sport. So it kind of accelerated my lifting to a place that I never thought it was going to be in 2 years.
If we roll it back ever so slightly, we do three main sport courses at school. It's Cambridge National, GCSE P and A level P, and we discuss this topic of drugs and sport. How is that mentally for you then, to know you're competing or potentially competing against people who are bending the rules or breaking the rules? How do you overcome that? How do you, like you say, how do you go to sleep at night knowing that you're the best clean athlete, but you just know that the people who are getting all the gold medals, how do you get over that? How do you not take that, maybe not personally, but how do you not become so frustrated by that fact?
I think when I was a kid, I was more frustrated. I think What my first coach said to me was, we can outsmart them because we've got sports science, we've got optimal nutrition, we've got the work ethic, we've got the hard work. And if you're willing to put it all on the line in a natural way and push yourself to limits that not many humans would even go to, you're going to catch a break one day and they're going to make a mistake. You just have to be ready to pounce on it. And if that's not motivation enough to beat somebody like that enhanced, then what is? And that's what, and for me, that's what started my kind of fascination of anti-doping, trying to change the system for the better, for athletes. Obviously now my PhD is in anti-doping. So I'm trying to inform policy changes in the future. But that conversation in the first week of me starting opened my eyes to a world that I never thought existed. I was quite naive, thinking that sport was fair and everybody played by the rules. But as we know, people are going to always want to, you know, they want to try find a way to find the edge. So, yeah, I guess as a kid, it was frustrating. But I've been lucky enough that, you know, having to look at your life and dissect it, every facet, to make sure it's the best it can be, to give yourself a chance, because has led me to, you know, to places where I've actually achieved things that is probably unexpected for a clean athlete at my sort of level. So, yeah, I've been quite lucky that I've had good people around me.
And I think in terms of, we're talking about anti-doping, I watched a documentary recently. I can't remember what it's called. It was on Netflix, yeah. And it was about the cycling one with Russia and the sort of whistleblower, yeah. Icarus. And it was, as they say in the film, it's a state-sponsored thing where it was literally a military regime in terms of how they did it. And it's mind-blowing. And I, like you say, frustrating. I think I as a person individually would struggle to deal with knowing that you're cheating and I'm not.
I was telling people about Russia years before it came out. Because yeah. As athletes, you see things, you hear things. Russia weren't secretive about it.
Yeah.
They were very arrogant about it. And I was telling people years before it came out that I think they're doing something they're not supposed to. And people just thought I was bitter because I was getting beaten by them. And I was like, no, they really are doing stuff they're not supposed to. And then obviously when it came out, they're like, okay. And he was right. And he wasn't just bitter. But look, Russia weren't the only ones. Let's be like clear. Like, Russia got caught because of the whistleblower. We know that other countries are probably doing the same thing. Just not getting caught. So the system needs to get better. It knows that. Unfortunately, it just hasn't got the resources to keep checking every single individual country where they're kind of having faith that the country is trustworthy. I'm a big critic of the system, but at the same time, it probably does need about 4 or 5 times more funding to be able to pull it off. And I'm a big kind of advocate in terms of more funding for the system, even though I'm quite a harsh critic of it. So, I'm hoping I'm quite balanced in my argument.
But I think a lot of it comes from, as well, in terms of, you say a lot of countries are doing it, but it's almost that shop window effect, that if a country that may be struggling economically or with their society, they all of a sudden get a few golds. It's like, oh, look at us, look what we're doing, we're incredible. And you see it from the sort of that Eastern Bloc, from even like the 80s, where you see all the gymnasts now, where they all get caught, and the old track athletes, long jump, high jump, all the sort of Russian, Ukraine, that sort of area, East Germany, whatever. And it was that almost, we call it start the soft power, in terms of it looks amazing to the people in the country, so it makes them feel better. Whereas behind the scenes, that country's not really succeeding in anything other than their state-sponsored things. So let's go away from that a little bit. You go back to your 19th birthday, you broke that record. How do you stop yourself getting carried away then with the sort of hype behind you, in terms of, it's obviously very good to accept that and appreciate it and enjoy it, but how do you not get carried away with, I'm the best, look at me? Or do you use that to fuel yourself going forward?
No, because I think my coach at the time, he was quite a scary man. You never really got a compliment from him. And if you did, it's very, very rare. So like, I never got to a place where I was arrogant with it. In fact, I didn't think it was good enough. You have to remember, like, that British record only put me like last on that list to qualify. I literally got the last automatic place. I was 10th. So like, I knew I wasn't the best, but I was 10 years younger than everybody else. Only 2 years in the sport. So the potential was there, but I was never going to medal in Beijing. The kind of the aim was to go have the experience, compete against the very, very best the sport has to offer at the time, learn from it and come back in 4 to 5 years and, you know, be up there. So, I was lucky that the coach that I had initially he didn't take any arrogance at all. And every single day was it was a bit of like, it was literally a slugfest. It was all about, so it was not very scientific. It was just like hard work, grueling. And, you know, like at 19, 20, when your body's absolutely aching all the time, you know, you're working pretty hard. Obviously he was a military man, so I got that too. So yeah, I was never arrogant with it at all. In fact, I knew I was not good enough. I had to always aim for the top guys, and until I became close to them, then I started thinking, okay, I'm half decent.
And how did you then prepare to travel to the event? How did you prepare mentally to travel? So obviously the training's going to be hard work, and it's all programming and deloads and resting and making sure you're recovering properly. But mentally, how did you prepare going into then? You say that you went in 10th place, to know that, you know, there's almost not, there's no expectation, but you're going in 10th. You know that anything above that is a bonus. How do you fuel yourself mentally to overcome and try and get towards the medals?
Well, I think at 19, it was never about a medal. I was never considered a medal chance, because juniors just don't medal in our sport at that age, unless they're doing something they're not supposed to. So the idea was, don't come last. If you can beat some of the top seniors, then that's a bonus. But the thing is, because of my kind of my development the last 2 years, we still had about 6 months before the games took place. So there's still a lot more of improvement in me, at a rate that none of the seniors were going to do that sort of improvement, because they're getting to a level that, you know, they're talking about little like improvements every year. But I put on 90 kilo in 2 years. So, you know, why not had another 5-10 kilo on that? You know, and that will put me right up there, not medal wise, but maybe fifth or sixth, which is great. And then what I did was I got into college, and I had a gap year because I knew that I needed it to potentially give myself the best chance to try and, you know, just do the best I can at the games, and not to come last. And yeah, so I was training twice a day, 4 times a week, like really, really difficult sessions, thinking that it could be the difference. And, you know, I got into the last competition I did was the British Championships, I think, before I went out there. And I absolutely annihilated the British record. Like, absolutely, it was just like I got to a level that if I'd done that 6 months before, I would have qualified in probably seventh or sixth, so quite high. So I knew I was going like probably the best shape I've ever been. So I got to Beijing. But what we do is that you always have a training camp before to get used to the environment. So we went to Macau, Hong Kong, for the training camp for about a week, 10 days. And then we flew up to Beijing into the village, which was a kind of huge eye-opener. I keep saying to people, like, think about Vegas for athletes, but 24/7. Like, it is crazy. Like, it doesn't sleep, but that's a distraction because you want to try everything and you want to meet everyone. And definitely, like, Usain Bolt was there at the time. Like, these are superstars, and I'm just like this kid that was just mind blown. And you're part of a British team that you have a lot of superstars on that team that you only like see on TV, and you're literally in the same team as them. So I had to make sure that I didn't get distracted. I was there for a job and not to have fun. Obviously, you can have fun, but do it after you've competed. So everything was going like, you know, I was comfortable all the way up to probably 3 days before I competed. And on my last training session, I lifted a weight that on the day of the competition, I would have won me bronze. Yeah, so I knew I was in great shape. Like, yet again, I'd put in another 5-7 kilo on what I did at the British because it was 2 months away. And I was, so at the time, there was no, Facebook was out, but not really, you couldn't really, like, you had to email people back then. And texts were very expensive. So I emailed my coach saying, look, this is what I've done. And he emailed back saying he was happy, but he said, look, calm down. Remember, you're not there to medal. Enjoy it. And what, if you remember, just the idea is just don't come last. But that's what we want. Don't come last. Do not put yourself under that added pressure of I'm going to medal. If it happens, it happens. If it doesn't, it's fine. Don't worry. you can come back in four years. But obviously, like me being 19, I was absolutely like, I think I want a medal. I'll be the youngest ever to medal. I can't believe it. I want to do it. And the night before I competed, I went to the food hall, came back, and I started feeling very sick. I didn't know what was wrong with me. I thought that I probably had food poisoning or something. And then kind of got seen by the doctor, and they said it was like a head cold or maybe the flu. But I thought, I've actually trained through colds and flus before. This is not like anything I've ever had. So that night, I was on the toilet all night, like vomiting and lots of other symptoms, like dehydrated, really sweaty, achy, fatigued. Woke up about 3 kilo lighter. So really bad, yeah. Didn't know what was wrong with me. The next morning when I got seen, they were going to pull me out. And I said, no, look, I'm here. I've literally killed myself to be here. It's an honor to even be it, like, let's compete. I was never going to medal anyway. I'm going to try not to come last. That's it. So on the day, luckily, I didn't come last, which is good. But I was 7 kilo below that lift 3 days ago, which would have won me bronze. So instead of coming third, I came ninth out of 12. But I, you know, the one thing that was probably the biggest positive is that even though I was so ill, I managed to put a performance together, because that's the first kind of adversity that I've had in terms of sport. Two, I had at the time the greatest lifter come up to me, who, like, it was probably the greatest ever. And he said, look, at 19, I was nowhere near you. He said, you're gonna be a superstar. So, like, and that was him. And I couldn't believe I had him say that. So even though I was really disappointed and upset, I knew that I was young enough to come back. And I knew that I was probably 30 kilo better off than any other lifter at my age when they were my age. I just had to kind of, took it as like, I got unlucky, I got sick, and we'll go home and we'll regroup for London, not knowing what was wrong with me. So
it's like a double-edged sword, isn't it? You've had all that, look what I can do, and then you've had the illness, but then you've had somebody come up and give you that positive after, and it's taking the right positive and it's balancing that out with the negative and not getting carried away. So could you then tell us about what happened then going forward with that illness? Because obviously it was a sign of something else in the future. So could you give us a bit of detail about that?
Yeah, strangely enough, I had probably 5 more days in Beijing, and actually it got a little bit better. So I thought, maybe it was a head cold. Maybe I was just being weak, even though it didn't feel like a cold at all. Then I got back to the UK and things started to get even worse. I lost 25 kilo in body weight in 8 weeks. Wow. Yeah, that's like 4 stone nearly in 8 weeks. I was in a bad way. I was bedridden for the whole of it. I was seeing blood in the toilet. I wasn't eating. So my body weight went from probably 67, 68 kilo all the way down to like 48, 47. I was literally stick thin. And obviously, you know, I was quite a chubby kid. So for my parents to see that was quite worrying. And the pain that I was in, that was probably the one thing that I remember, that this was pain. I was constant pain. I wasn't sleeping. My kind of lifting career was pretty much over in 8 weeks. I tried to go back to the gym and I was collapsing. I couldn't do anything. So my bench went from 190 kilo to struggling to put on 140. Just couldn't do anything. So I went to the GP, and this is what they said. They said, like, look, you've gone through a very stressful experience. You put your body through quite a lot. It's just a reaction. Like, you're fine. And I was like, really? I think I know my body pretty well, and this is not normal. He goes, yeah, that's what stress does that to you. I was like, really? Does it? Like, I can be at the top level of sport. That's stress. Like, this is not this is a little bit more than that. And now I got kind of set. Like, yeah, they said, just go home, come back in 2 weeks if it doesn't clear up. And 2 weeks later, it was worse. So did some bloods, and I got a call within like 24 hours saying, get to the hospital now. They're abnormal. So that started a process that was quite scary, because they started testing me for like cancer, And luckily it wasn't, but it took about 9 months of tests to find it was Crohn's. At the time, I had no clue what Crohn's was. I just thought that you'd give me some sort of medication, I'll be on my way. But no, the consultant was quite clear. He said, look, you're in for the biggest fight of your life sort of thing, to one, stay healthy, two, to counter any effects of the medication, and the medications are toxic, but you need them. And three, in his head, there's been no athlete with Crohn's to ever win a medal at any Olympic or Paralympic Games. This was 2009. And he said, I think you should retire. You're not going to be able to do this. And I was like, nah, I can do it. Not knowing the roller coaster of what's going to come at me. It's weird. He was right about the medal, because I did look it up. And one Crohn's sufferer did attempt it, but she was American, but I think she came like 10th, her best position ever. And in a YouTube video, she was adamant that if it wasn't for her Crohn's, she would have reached her potential. So I knew it was going to be difficult. I just didn't know the gravity of what was going to come. So making that comeback was quite tough.
Could you tell us about Crohn's then? So for some of our listeners, some of the students who are watching, what is it? How does it hold you back? And in terms of the treatment, how did that hold you back as well? Because I'm willing to be sort of educated as well, because my knowledge of it is very minimal. But how did that affect you then? What were the symptoms? What were the effects and so on?
Yeah, so Crohn's, so basically your immune system protects you from viruses. Mine attacks me instead. So not only have I not got an immune system, when it attacks me, it gives me loads of like horrible symptoms. So for example, ulcers in the intestine, which bleed, chronic fatigue, like really extreme fatigue, obviously like blood in the toilet, no appetite, so you can't actually fuel yourself to train, can't recover. The one thing that got me the most was probably the extreme pain that you're in. It's pain that can make you probably, I've passed out from it, the pain. I've literally been that painful that I've woken up thinking, oh, what's happened? I've actually passed out from the pain. Unfortunately, even though the medication's there to make sure that it reduces your symptoms, the medication itself is very toxic long-term. It gives you loads of other problems on top. But at the top level of sport, when the fine margins are like 0.1%, that puts you at a huge disadvantage because you can't train the way you used to. And you have to try and kind of know the medication and what it does to your body inside out for you to implement a plan to try and outsmart it. And that is very difficult when you've got something that's going to throw everything at you.
That's a huge roller coaster in terms of your sort of 18 months, and you've had that amazing sort of notification that you're going to the Paralympics, and you get there and you're just beforehand, you're breaking records and you think, I have a match that I'm getting bronze, and you get there and you're sick and then you compete. So it's down into a negative in terms of you knew what you could have achieved. Then someone tells you all the potential you have. Then it goes down again and you get diagnosed and you get told all these sorts of negatives and nothing to build you up. You've obviously got a lot of mental strength because you go on to success after that. And how do you, could you give us that journey from getting all that news and going on to the treatment and recovering from it to your success? Because obviously I imagine it's not a big linear line that goes straight up. It's up and down, a roller coaster ride from then on. Could you tell us then your then journey to the next major competition?
So I was out for about 2 years trying to get healthy. So I was kind of pretty much retired to a lot of people. And there's no way back. I don't think even the national team expected me to come back. The kind of what I had in my head was I was not going to let Crohn's be the reason that I retired. It had to be the reason that I carried on and really pushed it to limits that no human's ever pushed it. Because you know, if you can't, if something's impossible, well, we know from history that whatever's been impossible has been done. So I thought, why can't I do it? I had the resources to, I had access to the top practitioners in the country, the top research at the time. I was lucky in terms of compared to other Crohn's sufferers is that I monitored that at a level that no other Crohn's sufferer on the planet's monitored to. So we can see the trends, we can see the patterns, we can adapt like literally every day to try and outsmart it. And I just knew that I had that sort of resource. So I thought, well, I've got it all at my disposal. Like, then it's just now on me to kind of fight every day, make sure that I'm doing everything that I can to pull it off. And I knew there was going to be a lot of suffering, like probably you can probably take it to a place that's really, really dark consistently. And you're going to have more frustrating days and bad days than good days. But imagine being the first person to pull it off. How would that feel compared to everything else you've been through? And I thought that was worth it.
That sort of stems back to that first bit of inspiration that you had with seeing Michael Johnson on the podium in terms of imagine what that feels like, imagine what it would be like to be in his position. And you're now in a position where you have that chance to be the first person that's ever felt that way after coming back from Crohn's disease. So I didn't want to interrupt you, but I just thought it really related back to the reason why you had that passion, desire to do it. Sorry, carry on.
I think you're right. But I think at the time, I didn't really think of the Michael Johnson thing. It was more like, oh, nobody's ever done it. This is an opportunity. Yes, I know it's bad. I know my parents don't want me to carry on. I know my friends and my family. And I think my girlfriend at the time, actually, I think that was the start of our downfall because she just couldn't take what I was going through. We were quite young as well. So I guess that was hard on her. But I knew that I had to be selfish. I knew that goals are not going to, I can't rely on my parents and my friends and my family to support me because it was crazy what I was doing. I was putting myself at huge risk. I knew the risks I was putting myself in. It was my responsibility. It was my choice. I was kind of well informed of what was going to come. I took that choice to fight. Unfortunately, other people just didn't understand. And sometimes you have to stand alone and go through it by yourself. And you have to kind of shut out the noise. And the noise that I had in my head was, I could be the first. That's the noise that I had. And I was willing to suffer for it. But I knew it was coming. So it's not like I was unexpected. So yeah, it was all about, for me, it was all about kind of accumulating enough consistent days to give myself a chance. That's all it was. Just accumulate every single day, do everything you can on a daily basis rather than looking in the future. Because if you keep looking at the outcome, it can distract you on a process that is complicated. It is challenging. And you have to have two eyes on the process because if you have one eye on it, you're going to get caught out. And in my situation, it could be fatal. So I had to make sure that every day was the best it can be and get to the outcome when it comes and just be ready. And that's what I did. So I was lucky that in my comeback, I managed to get to 2012, break the European record there. And then obviously from 2012 to 2016, I was unbeaten with the world records, with all the titles. And got that magic Paralympic medal in Rio. So, you know, I did it. It took me a while, but, I did prove that it could be done.
I love that in terms of, just going back ever so slightly, in terms of outcome and not having your eye on the outcome because it'll affect your short term. And on a more simplistic level, we talk about it in P in terms of the short, medium and long term goals, that if you set a long term goal, you're probably not going to get there. If you set lots of little short ones and a little bit of progress, feeling good, a little bit of a momentum almost, you're more likely to achieve the outcome than setting something in the distance. So what was that feeling like then in terms of, You know yourself, you were always a one-track mind. You were going to fight it and overcome it. When you achieved the medal, how did that feel? What, obviously, you had that immense pride, but almost that sort of weight lifted that I did it. I achieved this, and this was down to me. And people said I couldn't do it, and I've showed them, and I've showed this person and that person. What was that sense of like euphoria like in terms of meddling?
To be honest, going into the Rio Paralympic Games, What was scary was that I was projected into the public limelight because I was Channel 4 for some weird reason picked me as one of the faces because of what happened in 2012 and what's happened to me with Crohn's and stuff. And with the way my form has been for the last kind of 3 years previously, they genuinely thought I was going to do it. And unfortunately, when you put me on billboards and advertisements, you've got every single Crohn's sufferer in the world literally has put that medal around your neck before you got there. So I, for the first time, I felt a little bit of, but I put myself under extreme pressure anyway. But the fact that I had to think about other people as well. Like that community, that Crohn's and colitis community, where they're literally, they're hanging on for this. They don't want it so badly. So going into it, it was a big, I knew my kind of my responsibility that I've got to do it now, especially with the form that I'm in. But the irony was that at the Olympics, obviously the Olympics is before the Paralympic Games. I remember I was at the holding camp for Rio, and got a message in the middle of the night going, "Can you believe it? We've just won, a Crohn sufferer just won a medal." I was like, "What?" Turned out the American girl, Kathleen Baker, a swimmer, had won silver that night. And I wasn't the first. And I was like, thank God. Thank God. But yeah, 2 weeks later, I got my medal, and we were, yeah. So I keep saying to her that she's the first, I'm second, but she's like, no, we did it together. So it was a very good year. 2016 was probably one of the best years in sport for Crohn's sufferers, because you had two people, one at the Olympics, one at the Paralympic Games, getting medals that had not been done before. So yeah, for me, it was a good moment to share it with her.
Yeah, that's incredible. What an incredible story. And in terms of inspiring people, not just inspiring people through sport, but you're inspiring people who have, they can relate to you, people who are suffering from Crohn's and colitis, and then people who are suffering with similar disability yourself in terms of amputees and people born without whatever limb, arm, leg, whatever, and they take that inspiration. And I think, look at the Paralympics as that in terms of inspiration. You know, nothing's going to hold you back. I go to the gym and I can bench 110, and that would be an absolute max. And you said earlier, and it made me think, God, that's incredible that you'd lost the weight, and you were saying that you were so weak and you could only bench 140. And I was thinking, I'd like to bench 140 on a weekday. That's incredible. But in terms of you then achieving a medal, you've inspired so many people. Going from that Olympics and then preparing for Tokyo, and obviously the setbacks recently in terms of it being moved on a year, how are you monitoring, or how are you managing Crohn's now, and how are you preparing for Tokyo?
So that's the question that I think people are kind of questioning me now with my form the last 5 years. So ever since Rio, I had the biggest flare up of my career, my Crohn's. So obviously that stress on the body, what I pushed myself through to try and get that medal, has cost me. So after Rio, I had a massive flare, and to be fair, like, I didn't compete for 2 years, didn't compete to 2018. So my career was pretty much over in 2018. I was thinking about completely walking away from the sport, because every medication available to me wasn't working at all. So I don't know how I managed to get to the Commonwealth Games in medaling. I obviously won the European Championships 4 weeks later. But then, you know, my Crohn's are like, no, I'm not going to give you any sort of space now. I'm just going to keep coming at you. And unfortunately, in October 2018, I got the kind of, it wasn't a diagnosis, it was more of a options of, I had two more options left on the table for treatment, but they required me to potentially retire. There was no way back from these two options. One was a stem cell trial, which required aggressive chemotherapy for about a year, so it would pull me out. And the other one was a stoma bag. In both instances, there's no way back now. Now, I had the choice to make, because my health was literally on the line. I was really, really struggling. So I went home that evening and I actually asked myself whether or not I was satisfied with my career. Can I walk away now? I think looking at my kind of ask myself, actually, like, yes, I am satisfied. I've done everything that not many people have done, especially with a condition like I have, but I wasn't ready to completely walk away. And obviously I knew back then Tokyo was 2 years away. So I presented a plan myself to my team, and they freaked out at first, but it was not one of them options. It was another one that wasn't available to me. At the time, it was a potentially riskier option at the three, but all three were risky. And I knew what was going to come with it was it's going to be unpredictability. It's going to make sure that we're going to be as adaptable as possible, knowing that you know, we're gonna have to go to places that we don't want to go in terms of how we're gonna get through this. The team had to risk as much as I did, probably more because they're responsible for me. If not, it's my responsibility and kind of my decision. And ever since then, it's been ridiculously difficult to emulate how I used to be. And I might not actually make the games this year, to be honest. If I'm going to make the games, it'll be making up the numbers. It won't be a medal because I think with what my body's gone through, it's been the worst negative transformation you're ever going to see from anybody. So a lot of people see transformations as a good thing. Mine's been like the opposite. So I'll barely qualify if I qualify this year. And if I do medal, I think it will be a better achievement than I did it 5 years ago, because of what I've had to go through this time. I've literally pushed Crohn's to the very limits that anybody's ever taken the last 5 years, and it's not going to be enough. But I keep saying that. Some wars you have to fight knowing you're probably going to lose it because of what you learn from yourself and everybody around you. So that's going to be my year if I get there.
But in terms of you having the Crohn's disease and meddling in at the Commonwealth Games, I think maybe beforehand, if somebody had told you that you were going to have these sorts of difficulties, you wouldn't have maybe believed. You'd have still been able to push yourself to that limit and still achieve. But you've obviously still got it inside you to keep pushing and keep chasing that dream of going to that Tokyo Olympics when some other people may have just retired and thought, right, that's it. I'm going to take one of those two options. I'm not going to push myself. But there's obviously something there inside you. As you say, are you happy with your career? Do you want to still achieve? And you're still pushing to make the games and obviously showing a lot of mental strength and skills that potentially can't be learned. I think they're either in us or they aren't. And you're showing those skills that you've obviously been born with and you've developed through childhood to keep pushing. And could you tell us then, so I'd like to try and keep up to date with that. And I think some of our students listening as well, when are those qualifying events so we can sort of keep an eye on it and sort of get behind you that way?
I competed 3 weeks ago and that was a disaster. I missed out on that. So basically this time around, I have to be top eight in the world to qualify. At the moment I sit in ninth. So quite close. Got pimped on the day. But there's two more competitions potentially next month. So one in Georgia next month, and then the last one's in Dubai in June. I can only go to one because one, we're trying to limit how much I fly because of COVID, because I'm very, very, very vulnerable. So I have to pick wisely which one I go to. And if, as I said, if I do qualify, it'll be barely. But for some, it's weird, like, even though my body's completely changed from 5 years ago, my mentality hasn't. I'm still the same person. My application is the best it's ever been. The process is the best it's ever been. The most rigorous it's ever been. It's just that sometimes, and I keep like saying to people that want to kind of, when we talk about legacy, and I think what I say to people is, no matter what happens this year with me, don't judge me on a medal. Judge me that I actually didn't give up. That's what you should judge me on, like my application. Don't judge me on the medal, because you can win medals by not performing very well. But nobody thinks about the process when they're judging people. And as long as my application's high and the process is the best it can be, then I think I can walk away from Tokyo knowing that I gave it everything. Like, there's nothing more I could have done. And I got beaten eventually by the accumulation of the effects of medications that are so toxic that I shouldn't really be competing anyway. So I managed to get to a level that nobody's ever taken it to. So, and that for me is my medal.
I love that you've referred to that as well, because we look at elite athletes and we think, look at the glory and look at competing on the world stage, but nobody ever thinks about what happens behind. And even you just saying there, you know, you've got to choose between Georgia, and Dubai, because of the risk to your health. And you don't think about that. You don't think about looking at somebody competing abroad and thinking the traveling could have done it. And obviously you're saying that you're vulnerable to COVID. We never see that unless we hear it from an athlete themselves. We just see the glory, we see the outcome, and we never see the steps in place. Moving on, in terms of your advice, and what advice would you give to somebody who's suffered from Crohn's disease or any disabled athletes looking to sort of maybe not go to the Paralympics, maybe not even compete on the highest level, but to keep pushing themselves and push through things that, you know, potentially could hold them back or a barrier. What advice would you give to overcome those challenges and barriers?
I think I would say to people that, like, the best way to get through a barrier or an obstacle, it's your perception of that obstacle. So if your perception is negative, then you're going to quit. But actually, if you look at the obstacle as the opportunity to not only push yourself, but to learn new skills and to further yourself, you're going to find a way to get over that obstacle. You go over it, you go under it, you go through it, you go through the side of it. But there is a way. There's always a way. It's whether or not you're willing to put the effort in to find that way. And we know that, like, along that way, along that path, there's going to be a lot of, you know, it's going to be unpredictable. You're going to be pushed to the limit. But it's whether or not you are so kind of passionate about that goal that you're willing to put yourself through it. And sometimes it's like, right, how much do you want that goal? Can you afford to quit? And in 7 years time, look back and go, I regret that. Do you want to live with regret or do you go for it? And if you go for it on the day and it doesn't work out, great. You've learned that actually you can push yourself. Sometimes you won't achieve it. Sometimes you will, but at least then you've learned new skills you can apply in the future. But if you don't go all in, no matter what happens, you're not going to really learn much about yourself. And I always say to people, like, it's about reaching your potential in life. It doesn't matter if you get to the top level or not. What is your potential? Forget about other people's potential. Don't compare yourself, because nobody's you. So it's all about trying to reach your own potential and your true happiness. So for me, I'm happy pushing myself to the limit until I get to.
I love that. I'm going to have to clip that up and get that onto Instagram and whatever and get it sort of written up into a little motivational song. Because in the Blue Room at the moment, our Blue Room is the gym. And I'd love to get that quote up in terms of everything you've just said. And I think it's extremely motivational. And finally, what advice would you give to athletes, any sport, any age, any gender, whatever? What advice would you give to them? I imagine it's going to be quite similar to that in terms of pushing yourself to your potential. And if you're the best, amazing. If you're not, who cares? You've got no regrets. You've pushed yourself and who cares? But what advice would you give to athletes?
So if I had to probably advise myself like 10 years ago, the one thing I'd probably say is probably two things. One is have patience. And that's the one thing that as a kid I never did. And two, be the most adaptable person, because the most adaptable person is going to get you where you want rather than the best person. I always say, like, for example, this year, you're going to get there's a surprise medalist at the Olympic and Paralympic Games because it's the person that's adapted the best for COVID and lockdown. They're the ones that are going to do well, not the best athletes technically. So always be adaptable, because if you can maneuver away when there's things being thrown at you left, right and center, you're going to have a shot. And others might fall behind. So always be adaptable.
I love that. Thank you. And thanks for giving up your time this afternoon to put this together. There's so much in there that I think people are going to love. And I've found it really sort of educational, inspirational myself listening to that. So thank you so much for giving up your time afternoon. And we've got those dates as well. So I'm going to make sure I'm sort of keeping up to date with that and seeing your sort of progress, hopefully onto Tokyo next year. So thank you for today.
Thank you.
Well, what a life we've just had the pleasure of learning about and experiencing with him as he sort of explained some of the challenges he's been through. And I think you'll join me in wishing the best of luck for those qualifying events for Tokyo 2021. This brings an end to our first series of podcasts. Shortly, we'll be releasing some snippets from each one that you might find interesting before we start filming for series two. Thanks for your support during the first series, and I hope you can come back and enjoy series two in a couple of months' time.